early morning. It's great to see all these red shirts out here. Such a bright and lovely group. So, sorry, this is kind of loud. This morning we have our special council workshop. We're doing workshops once a month. And so it is such a wonderful opportunity to have discussions. And so we have a couple discussions this morning, and we have several of our planning and zoning members here. Thank you for also joining us. But the first item on the agenda this morning is the horse park. So before we get started, let's do our, you know what, we have a tradition, which is that we pray and do the pledge. Randy, can I ask you to pray?
Sure.
Let's pray and do the pledge, and then we'll.
Father, we do thank you for this morning, the time that we will have over the next couple hours to deliberate on issues that are of importance to the city. For those that have shown up, I just thank you for their willingness to serve the city. Thank you for our mayor and council for her leadership and that of the council in the decisions that we're making. We just pray that you give us wisdom and knowledge, and we thank you for all that you have done for us and are doing for our city. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.
Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Ricky. So before we get started, just a reminder that we've got McDonald's breakfast sandwiches, cuties, and bananas back there, coffee, water. If anybody wants this for everyone, so please help yourselves. So this morning, we get to talk about the roll call details. Let's do roll call.
Rodriguez?
Here.
Bruner?
Here.
Sangula?
Here.
Levi? Haverfield?
Here.
And Bauer?
Here.
With the food, I totally lost the most important thing, roll call. Okay, so it's wonderful to have the representatives here from that are going to talk to us from the Stampede and from the Foundation and from the Horse Park. And Andrew, thank you for all being here. And so we're going to begin with your presentation, and I'm just going to let you go for it. We're ready. Good morning, Curtis.
Good morning. Well, we appreciate the time that you're letting us have this morning, and we'll try to make it painless. Sometimes when I talk, it's not painless, but we'll try to do good. The important thing about it this morning, I'd like to, well, thank you, and I'd like to thank all the people in red shirts that showed up this morning. Somebody asked me, do we need to say anything? I said, no, just wear your red shirt and look pretty. We're halfway there. We do have our red shirts. I would like to thank the members of the Park Foundation, Idaho Horse Park Foundation, for being here too. Several of those people here. And where I'm a member of both sides, so I wore my red shirt and the vest from the foundation. Because it's important. About 107 years ago, the rodeo started. But from history, in 1913, that's 109 years ago, they had a fall festival, harvest festival start. So they'd get together, the citizens of Nampa, the men and the women would have their celebration, and they had, the first time that they have recorded was called the Buck Show, and that was, they would rope off an area down by the post office, and they would just ride horses out there. But they quit that when one of the horses got loose and started tearing down women's clotheslines around the deal, run through several clotheslines. So my area to cover this morning is goals and the needs and the benefits. So the people in 1913, they had a goal to have a good time to celebrate the harvest, and their goal was to get a place with a fence around it. So they eventually got there, and in 1915 was the first recorded year the Harvest Festival or the rodeo started, so we're in our 107th year this year. And so some of the benefits that they had was to be where we are today. I just wonder, you know, when you think about where they started in the history of Nampa back then, I think the speed limit around 1914 was 7. Because they had started getting cars here in Nampa, and they started, people were already, Joe Huff can tell you that, they were already writing tickets and complaining about cops being out there. So we've come a long ways, and through the cooperation of a lot of people here in Nampa that's grown. I was watching the Cowboy Channel the other night and Houston Rodeo Show, and they have millions of people come every year. That's one of the biggest rodeos in the world. And they mentioned Nampa several times here and then. Because the same announcers that they have, we have here during our rodeo. So about 20 years ago, when, well, in 1997, the city and the rodeo joined forces in Nampa Development, and they built the Idaho Center. And I think our first rodeo there was 1997. And then about 2002, and I could be off a year or so on that, the Horse Park Foundation was formed. Some of those folks are here today that actually was on that from the very start. And so it's grown in 20 years, the Horse Park, and we're now sponsoring about 26 shows a year, bringing in an estimated $30 million a year in economic development. We have one letter in your packet from a couple that coming down every year, and last year they bought 3 new Dodge pickups when they were here. So the economic areas here, and we're excited each year that that we can grow. So what we'll present today, and Paula Cook will be joining us in a minute on Zoom, and then Sherry Boardman will talk about what our goals are, what our needs are. And we've worked closely. It's not four separate units anymore. It's four partners, and that's the city, which is you folks, and with the rodeo, and with the horse park, and the Idaho Center. And right now, you've got the best management at the Idaho Center that I think you've ever had. And I was there when they first built it, and through the police department was a part of that. And I appreciate Andrew Luther and his group right now. They've had a couple of times, you know, the last couple of years. In 2020, it was a challenge for all of us. But on some of the things that happened at the park that year, I think we still had 26 horse shows. And when you get, it's like the rodeo brings in over 7, last year was over 800 contestants from 28 different states and 3 different countries. So it's Nampa's come to that forefront. We just need to go forward with that where we're going to be in a few more years. Some people won't be here in a few years, but it's all right, somebody will. And they'll look back and see how the actions you folks take today will make a difference in the years to come. So I think that we're ready for Paula. And this is Paula Cook, and she's a member of the foundation. And she'll explain some of the things that she's done a lot of work for this. And so here she is.
And Curtis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We so appreciate you and your contribution and all you do. You've made a big difference, and thank you for that.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Joanna.
Good morning, Paula.
Good morning. Thank you, everyone, for allowing me to join you from the Marriott in beautiful downtown Norman, Oklahoma. This is a little bit different for me doing this remote because I like to use my hands, and it's going to be harder for you all to see my hands as I talk. But I'm joining you today with a viewpoint from a few different aspects. I'm a business owner with offices in Nampa, right in front of the Idaho Center, actually. I'm a longtime exhibitor at the horse park. I show horses, and my daughter Annabelle shows horses. I've spent many a day enjoying the beautiful facility that we have. And from that aspect, that's my heart aspect in talking about the park. But I mean, today really my viewpoint is from a member of the foundation and coming with the desire to educate you and the public about the intrinsic value of the park. Now, I think that few people are arguing the park cultural and entertainment value. It's a wonderful venue in our city. It gives people an opportunity to come and enjoy the Western heritage and the Western lifestyle that is the foundation of Idaho and of the Treasure Valley. I think what a lot of people haven't historically understood is the economic impact that our park has had on our community. Our park has over the years grown and has infused a reliable and steady stream of income into local businesses, as this referenced. Our exhibitors buy trucks, they eat in the restaurants, they go to Walmart, they contribute money in a variety of ways to our city. So when I decided to analyze this data, I looked around at different algorithms to use to provide a reliable and understandable formula, use a reliable and understandable way to communicate our economic impact. I come to this from a financial background. I'm not an economist, I'm not an accountant, but I spent my career in the high-tech industry analyzing financial data and communicating that data to stockholders and shareholders and the people who participate in our company. So my training was from one of the most widely recognized CFOs on Wall Street. He was very conservative and very honest, and that's so I come from being groomed in that capacity. It was a long time ago, so we'll see if I remember much when I'm presenting this. Okay, enough about that. I'll talk about the formula that I used. I identified a formula that was originally made by the City of Fort Worth, Texas, and the American Corpus Association. The American Quarter Horse Association is the largest breed registration horse association in the world. It has thousands and hundreds of thousands of members and registered thousands and thousands of horses. They have a very strong interest in identifying the economic value of the horses to the events that they attend. The City of Fort Worth, I don't know how many of you have been, but it is a very equine-centric economy. Fort Worth has the Fort Worth Stockyards. They host many of the largest horse shows in the United States and in the world. They also have some of the largest rodeos and events there. So the AQHA and the City of Fort Worth developed an algorithm that uses the number of equine participants at any event to determine the economic impact of that event. But what the formula does, I'll try to make it's simple and complex at the same time, but the formula uses the equine participants to extrapolate the number of human participants, and then the number of human participants at any event are multiplied by the number of days. They add a day for check-in or check-out, move-in or move-out, to an event, which is conservative. Usually there are two extra days, but they add a day for that, and then that's multiplied by a per diem that they have developed determining how much money people spend per day while they're there. The per diem is $150 per day currently, and that delivers the economic impact of an event to the city and surrounding community. It was readily apparent that that was the gold standard for developing an economic impact statement about a venue or an event. So I chose that because it has been refined over the years. It's conservative. The way it's been refined, as an example, is that when it was first developed, the algorithm stated that when a dollar was spent in the community, that it was turned over 7 times in the community. So in other words, if my kids go to the concession stand with my Wish to Charge card, they buy meals and ice cream for 10 of their friends. That money then, the original formula would say, was spent 7 times more in the community. Over the years, as the real data was analyzed compared to the algorithm, it was changed to the fact to demonstrate that the dollars were turned over 4 times in a year. They said it was impossible to track it up to 7 times. That makes sense. Just a few years back, the formula was further refined to reflect that a dollar is turned over only 1 more time in a year. So the ice cream my kids buy, the money from that is spent 1 more time in the community, which to me, that seems conservative as well. So I guess the point is, this is a current and widely recognized algorithm used to determine the information that I'm about to present to you. As I started to build my models and my spreadsheets, I had one challenge, and that was that at the Idaho Center, as in a lot of venues, I think, numbers are reported in stall count. So we don't count how many horses, per se, are at an event. We count how many stalls are sold. Now, that seems like that should be one-to-one if you're not familiar with horse shows, but it's not. And the reason is that when a trainer, for example, comes to a horse show and brings horses, they rent stalls, and sure, horses live in those stalls, but some of those stalls, some percentage, are used for dressing rooms, places for our snacks, for tack rooms where we put our saddles and our bridles and brushes and all the things we need to support the horses. The number that, so I needed to reduce the number of that stall count by a certain percentage in order to be once again empirical and conservative and not overstate the numbers that I'm providing to you. The number that I chose to use when I was building my models was to say that for every 5 stalls sold, one of those stalls would not house a horse. So I reduced, obviously, every 5 stalls, I reduced it down to 4 as I built these models. That is super conservative. I know that from experience and from years of being around horse shows. For example, last fall, I showed at the Low Roller Reining Classic, which is put on by George King, and George will be speaking to you next with some of his viewpoints about from a horse show manager's perspective. But when I was showing at that horse show, my train had 18 horses there, and for those 18 horses, we had 2 stalls that supported our tack and our refrigerator with snacks and water, and where we put our hats and our chaps and all that stuff. So obviously that is a lesser percentage than the 1 to 5 that would say that 1 for every 9 stalls used was not used for a horse. That is more empirical data. As I said, I chose to be conservative. I took out 1 out of every 5 stalls rented when I applied my formulas. So given that, I will jump right into it. I'll just say briefly kind of what the actual numbers are. So the AQHA formula has determined that for every horse at an event, there are typically 3 people, an average of 3 people, who are attending with that horse, be it the spectators, the exhibitor, the trainer, etc. So if you take the number of horses at an event times 3 people, that gives you the total number of people at an event. Then, to determine how many days those people are there, you take the number of people times the actual show days, and as I mentioned, add 1 day for either move in or move out. Typically, it's 2 days, but on the conservative side, they add 1 day, and then that gives you the total number of people days. That's my statement. That's not how they say that, but it's the most easy for me to understand. Then when you have the total number of people days, times that times the $150 per day premium, That gives you the direct economic impact, the money that's sent directly into the community by people at that first show. So, without further ado, I'll start on page 7 of your packet. And one of the first things, I think is most important to demonstrate about the impact our fish park has is that it has been a reliable and steady stream of income in the community for many years. I applied data from 2015 to 2021. The data was provided to me by the wonderful Forest Park staff and management. And so I took that stall count data and I put it into my the numbers that you'll see in your report. So at the top of page 7, you'll see the attendance data and total event days by year. They seem a little bit dichotomous, but what I thought was important to highlight is the fact that even through COVID and the times when many businesses were completely shuttered, where many events were canceled, obviously we all remember that though. Was a difficult time in our economy for a lot of us. During that time, our horse park was still able to safely conduct our business. And we were able to hold events, we could social distance, everybody could do things outside. And so what I wanted to show with this graphic was that despite this disruption in the number of events we could hold, our events were reduced by the time they were canceled, and then we were able to safely include them again. But even though the event days from 2019 to 2020, the event days were reduced by 35%, the stall count, so even though those event days were reduced, our park was growing and people wanted to come and do things. And our stall count did decrease by 22% from 2019 to 2020, but obviously that's half the percentage of the events that were decreased. So what I'm trying to show is that even though the park was not able to operate at full capacity, we still were able to infuse a good revenue stream into the community. Our attendance at our events has grown steadily from 2015 to 2019 before that. And then in 2021, we had a record number of both event days and of stall shows shown, stall printed. If you want to see all of the data that goes into this, it's on the back of your packet. It's all at the very end, and I'm working both myself a spreadsheet and some graphics, so you can see more data than you probably would want to look at, but cut a few different ways, but it's very educational, and it's important to see how the park is contributing. I will just briefly go through this economic impact. In terms of dollars, as you can see with the graph, our infusion into the community in terms of dollars has grown steadily. In 2019, using my conservative formulas, our park contributed over $15 million in direct dollars into the community. In 2020, that amount dropped slightly to $11 million. But in 2021, we had a record impact of $22,600,098.50. So you can see that our park has grown, our participation numbers have grown, and that has extrapolated into a huge financial impact into our city and surrounding community. Community impact the term that I use to describe the dollars that were spent once again. So when my kids buy all those hamburgers, the Idaho Center goes and buys lettuce, and that dollar is spent once again in the city. So the community impact, just saying that dollar is spent only one more time, I also feel that that's a conservative estimate. The community impact in 2021 grew to over $45 million. Then on page 8, the total dollars contributed over the years, once again, trying to show that our park has contributed sustainable, steady revenue to our businesses in the community. It shows that total economic impact over those years was over $103 million contributed to the city directly, to the city businesses directly, and then obviously that extrapolates into almost $207 million over the 6 years that I analyzed this data. The average impact per year was just under $15 million spent in our local community, extrapolated obviously to almost $30 million if you count that those dollars are spent even one time in the community. That, what I hope that that conveys to everybody the importance of our park and sustaining the growth of our park so that we can contribute to provide this economic boost to our dealerships and our restaurants and our grocery stores and all of the places that our participants spend their money when they're visiting our wonderful park. So with that, I will conclude my presentation and welcome George King, who is the commercial manager, who can provide his perspective as the manager of some of the biggest events that are held at our horse park from his perspective. Thank you very much for your time.
Paula, thank you. And council will just, if there are any questions, we'll do it at the conclusion. And George, it's good to see you.
Hi. Thank you.
Did you drive up this morning?
No, I came last night.
I would guess, because you would have been driving.
Stayed in one of the nice motels here. Uh-huh.
Oh, welcome.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Anyway, for those of you I haven't met, my name is George King. So I am not only a member of the foundation, but I'm a customer. Okay, so I use the horse park. I'm from Idaho Falls. I'm a director and show manager for the Great Western Reining Horse Association. Just to give you a little bit of perspective, we started 10 years ago in 2012 with a partnership, and I call it a partnership. At that time, we had a vision. We wanted to have the largest reining horse show in the Northwest, and that was our vision, and we wanted to go do that. And it was a weekend that came open. And we were identified it here at the horse park, and so we jumped on it and we did it, 2012. We, just to kind of give you a perspective, we had, we sold 197 stalls at that horse show, 25 RVs, and we added $22,000 to the purse. What is added money? What does that really mean? Well, that means we put money in the purse so it pays out more money, and for you and I, it means more people show up. Because there's a greater chance for a bigger paycheck, right? And it's 10 years ago. 25 RVs, 197 stalls, 10 years. So last year was our 10th year anniversary. And this is where we have come. So instead of 22,000, we had $122,000 in added money. We had 614 stalls. And we had 122 RVs. Now, what does that mean? Well, let me just tell you where that's the growth that we've hit in 10 years. Not only that, did we add a second show. So in 2015, we added a show in the spring. It's exploded. This year, we're going to have $125,000 in added money in that show. Just crazy exploded. And because that's not enough, we're going to have a third show next year. We've already... In 2023, in June, we've already locked in dates for that. We're already advertising for it. We're going to add $150,000 to that show. And that one's kind of crazy, because what these shows have been is we have pulled people from all over. It's not just the largest reining show in the Northwest. What's happened is that over the last 4 or 5 years now, we've been in the top 25 in the world. The Low Roller in October was the 14th largest reining show. And that's based on total money paid out. When you look at the total number of entries, which is kind of what we're interested in, because that's people. It's not just a show where 5 people showed up and they paid out a lot of money. When you look at total number of entries come in here, we had the sixth and the seventh largest reigning show in the world here in Nampa. And we're hoping for a third show to go out and do the same thing. So what have we done? Next year, we will end up having these three horse shows. We will pay out in purse money $750,000. We will end up having, people will come to the city of Nampa and spend 30 days, because our shows average 10 days. You know, when you look at Paula's algorithm, well, we were about $7.3 million of economic impact in two shows. Next year, we're going to be a $10 million impact to the city of Nampa because of my just three shows. And that's incredible. Here's where I'm at. Trying to put on a horse show, I've had 120, I've had as many. In 2020, we get the standing record right now. And records are always meant to be broken, but while you've got it, you pat yourself on the back. In that October of 2020, we sold 708 stalls in that show. That was just crazy huge. 14 different states, three Canadian provinces. It was just, and those of you who actually got to come out and take a look, it was a crazy, crazy deal. But we were trying to figure out where to go put our RVs. Because you've got 44. You've got 44 RV hookups. Now, the horse park worked hard. They threw up generators and ran water lines and tried to help a lot of the others. We have like 50. That's, do your math, that's 94. There's a whole bunch of people who aren't getting an RV spot. They're not even getting any partial hookups. We're asking them to come here and spend thousands of dollars of their recreational dollars. That's what they're doing. They're coming to Nampa, spend a month here to vacation. Oh, and guess what? We want you to stay in your campers and your trailers, and we're not going to give you amenities. It just doesn't look good. I had a longtime customer who canceled and didn't come. Now, we lost his RVs, but he and his four customers didn't stay in the RV. You're like, oh, well, we lost that income. No, we lost 12 stalls. We lost all the money they were going to spend here. I lost a customer who had a lot of entries. I figured we lost $5,000 to $6,000 by them not showing up because we couldn't give them RV spots. The hard part is that we've been friends, but it wasn't just $5,000 or $6,000 at one horse show. I haven't been able to get him to come back yet. And that's just the guy who called and talked to me. He had enough courtesy to let me know that he wasn't going to come. I don't know how many of them didn't show up, but they never called. I don't even know about them. But I'm trying to run a business. I'm trying to expand and grow. You see where we've come in 10 years. Well, I don't want to just sit here and go, all right, well, it's not anybody else. Let's not grow and expand and improve our business, because we don't have anywhere to go. So what's really important to me is because we've done everything we can possibly try to do. We had a fundraiser. We raised $5,000 last year and gave it to the foundation to help towards RV park. Well, you know what an RV park costs. At that rate, I think in 200 years, I think we'll probably be there. We're not going to get there. You guys are the ones who are going to be able to get there. And what I'm just telling you is that I'm a small business, right? But I'm already impacting you. We're in your community by $10 million a year. And I'm asking you to go spend two at most. It's a partnership, and I want you to try to help me be able to build my business and keep it growing. We're not going to do it. The foundation's not going to do it. It's really dependent on you. Awesome. Thank you.
George, thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Madam Mayor, City Council members, thank you for letting us have this opportunity. And I want to thank my board. And the red shirt showing up today, for sure, in the face of the park board, and of course, Andrew. Thanks, everybody, for coming. We're here bright and early because we are all passionate. I'm Sherry Boardman. I'm the vice president of the, excuse me, I had to cough, sorry. of the Idaho Horse Park Foundation. And for those of you that don't know me, I am super passionate about the park. So I've been on the board as an active member pretty much since the beginning. I've witnessed the arduous path of development, been present through idle times, and within the last 10 years, the addition of Spectra Venue Management, the rise to success, and now currently at levels that we could have only dreamed of. This is an important project, and there is an urgent need to improve the valuable city asset. The horse park is at a crossroads where we can continue on, make improvements to remain competitive, or put the horse park at risk and the generated revenue. It seems pretty simple to me. The facility brings tourists into the community, and as we have presented, a significant amount of tourism revenue. Excuse me, annually. It is a city asset that we must continue to support and invest in to remain competitive. We're fortunate to have this facility. The draw and name recognition it brings for Nampa, Idaho is, and here's my catchphrase, a municipality dream. We are known all over the United States and Canada for the Snake River Stampede and nationally ranked horse shows that bring participants, their support staff, and families to our community. Paula Cook so eloquently presented the economic impact study from our current horse show events, and I want to reiterate, for the year 2021, there was a direct economic impact of $22 million for tourism revenue, which was contributed to our community. Again, during 2020, the pandemic year, due to the nature of horse shows and the fact that we could socially distance, almost every other revenue-generating avenue was closed to the Idaho, but the Idaho Horse Park still was able to generate $11 million in economic impact. Again, a municipality dream. In addition, there are the large sums that the Snake River Stampede generates. They reported $11 million plus dollars in 2021 of economic impact, and there are other various events held at the Idaho Horse Park Sports Center. So in 2021, conservatively, between the Snake River Stampede and the horse show events, that was $33 million plus that came to our community. So the estimated economic impact from the proposed increased RV capacity would be an additional $500,000 annually, with an indirect economic impact of $1.25 million. That's per year. This is based on the same national algorithm that we use to do our current economic impact study. The return on your investment would be realized over a 10-year operating budget or 2 years or less in projected economic impact. This is a very good investment. Just the projected direct revenue from the proposed RV addition is an additional $95,000 to $150,000 annually. And this would be realized through, of course, RV spot rentals, a reduction in the current cost that it takes to create temporary RV areas. And what that takes is they have to rent generators, they run water lines, they bring in waste disposal services, and this is all costly and it's less than ideal. And these temporary services cost about $50,000 plus per year. And increased stall revenue would, of course, be realized due to being able to house more participants, and that goes hand in hand with then food and beverage sales. The ancillary revenue benefits are tax benefits to the city, as more people stay locally. Hotel benefits is more participants, they bring their ancillary staff, and most of those people stay in the hotels. And, of course, restaurants and other local industries, such as general shopping, car dealerships, and many others. The Idaho Horse Park Foundation has great relationships with Spectra Venue Management, the Snake River Stampede, the Chamber of Commerce, and we're all united in recognizing the importance of the Idaho Center and the Idaho Horse Park. And we work closely to continue to promote tourism and great benefits provided to our community. Our board is involved and supportive of the auditorium initiative. And if passed, those revenues can certainly be used for maintenance and other projects in the future. We recognize the funds generated will lessen the burden on the city. The Idaho Horse Park Foundation is devout in continuing to fulfill our mission statement to preserve, promote, and develop the Idaho Horse Park. We've contributed well over $6 million to date towards development. Within the last 4 to 5 years, we paid for the conversion of the coverall, and we turned it into a full competition arena, which really increased our larger show capabilities, having two covered arenas for weather protection. We most recently paid for the preliminary architectural work to get this project to this point. We are committed to support upgrades and maintenance to keep our park attractive and competitive, And we accomplish this through our ongoing participant sponsorship programs and our biennial Equus and Overture fundraising event that is slated for October, and I hope you come because it's really fun. We enjoy it. We ask for support letters. If you note on page 24, we ask some of our park participants for support letters. And on page 24 of the packet, we have an out-of-state patron that's pledged $10,000 contingent upon the project approval. This is proof of how we are able to beat the bushes in support, because this project's urgency is beyond our fundraising needs. We need the city's help. So in closing, the project received merit from the Venue Management Advisory Commission, and their letter of support is enclosed in the packet. We need to protect this valuable asset. As George King stated, his shows are at capacity and have no room for growth. We want to expand these shows and the revenues they generate, not risk losing them. Without this investment, the horse park will become less competitive and unable to maintain and attract upper-level, high-number shows. This will lead to a decrease in operations budget and potentially a greater impact on the taxpayer. The Idaho Horse Park brings millions of tourism dollars annually to this community, and it is a city asset that is worthy of investment. Please consider making this a priority budget item. Let's keep our municipality dream alive and well in Nampa. Thank you so much, and we would love to be open for discussion and if we can answer questions. Thank you so much for your time this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you. So, first of all, you guys have worked hard on this presentation. I can tell a lot of work has gone into it, and thank you so much for the research and sharing everything that you've shared. And Council, we have a few minutes. We're running a little bit behind, but let's take just a couple minutes and see if we have any questions specifically, and you can state who you're directing our question to.
Mayor, please. If I could have Curtis come back up. So the Idaho MP board donates quite a bit of money to our community, and so far it's been similar to a one-way highway. Nothing's coming back in return. So in order to make the Stampede better than it is, I don't know how it could be what's number five in the country, what would you need for example, the RV spots or the business aspect of the Fort Idaho Center to make it better than it is, to bring more revenue?
Well, you're right. I just some close figures. Since the Green Queen, that was the one on Garrity, opened in 1950 when Gene Autry was here. And they have averaged about 50,000 people per year that attend rodeo. So it stays around 60,000 that will have through there in that week. And what we do need is RV park. What I'm really worried about is if we don't get something started, I mean, to build an RV park, it's going to take some time when we get the funding. And the rodeo board itself, Sherry had said that the Horse Park Foundation has put in over $6 million. And I've presented this to you before, to most of you, about $5 million is what the rodeo board has put into this. We traded the acreage we had on Garrity for 2 weeks a year to use this the new park. So our business is good, but if we lose those RV parks, we have 44 and then they put in an extra 40 along the railroad. But if you go from the center of the railroad track towards the Idaho Center, they have 100-foot right-of-way. If the railroad comes in and says we're not going to release that to the city, we would lose every RV spot we have. So we have to have some place for them to go. And the thing is, the RV spots is not in competition with other RV parks in town because we only deal with the ones there at the Idaho Center. But it's like I said, it's number, the people in 1913, when the clothesline got tore down, wasn't expected to be number five indoor rodeo in the world, in the United States. But here's the deal, and I'm proud of it. This is the one we got this year, and normally we would loan this to City Hall to put it up down here somewhere, and I'll give this to the mayor. But we have, you say, what do we need? We really need the continued growth of the Idaho Center. We put the first 50,000 in there every year for like parks, the parking lots. There's so many things we bought, and the board put in $2.3 million to build everything on the side, the food courts, the restrooms, the rodeo club a few years ago. And that's all paid for back by the rodeo board. And the big coverall, we paid for that. We built the outdoor, where the amphitheater now, about $200,000 that the rodeo board put into that, do dirt work, because they were going to have an outdoor a rodeo. And so when Napa Development Center come on there, and they added some monies to it, and I have a sheet, and I won't bore you with that, but it's like the IC tickets office was $500,000. That was all privately funded. Didn't cost the city anything. So we just need some help for the upkeep and to put money back into the Idaho Center so we can make that better for the future. That's our goal, and the benefits are great.
Follow up, Mayor.
Yes.
Curtis and maybe Andrew, if the city was to give you an amount of, I'm just going to throw it out, $2 million on the investment for the RV and for the amphitheater or to the Fort Idaho Center, what would be the turnaround time to pay that back to the city by using the funds?
For an RV facility directly, it'd be approximately 2 years on economic impact, but 8 to 10 on our operating budget.
So that'd be a pretty quick turnaround because they're paying for it. It's not the city of Napa taxpayers paying for it, it's those who use the facilities are paying for it, right?
Correct, yeah, there'd be revenue generated from the people utilizing the facility.
Okay. And as far as the amphitheater, that one will be divided among the money that the council budgets for you, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of mechanisms to go about it, and just a couple of comments on the setup as a whole. You know, there's a lot of needs at the whole facility and at the Napa Civic Center. We can't forget about that venue as well, because that's important to the city and the taxpayers. But, you know, concerts are volatile. Horse park events are volatile. As we heard from George King, you know, he's going to do a month's worth of events in Napa. And I fear for the day that he would go away and go somewhere else. That would be very, very hard to replace and would take years to recover from. And, you know, there's short-term needs and long-term needs. And I would definitely be concerned if we're not addressing the short-term needs, as that's going to lead to breakdowns within the facility. That's going to begin to affect the rodeo. You know, when I got here, there was 20 tables at the Fort Idaho Center. 20 tables. And now we have hundreds of them. And those small things are going to add up and are reasons why we can be profitable today. Because we're cutting down those rental items, we're cutting down generators, we're cutting running tables, we're cutting running chairs, we're operating smarter, we're getting faster, we're getting safer and more efficient. And the RV project is certainly one of those projects that's going to, you know, be a high tide that can raise all ships.
Thank you, sir.
Mayor?
Thank you. Yes.
Could I add a comment?
Yes.
Okay. So based on what Andrew said, there were two measurements he used. One would be 2 years for the economic impact to recover within the city. But that's not refunding the city. It's 8 to 10 years to refund the city an investment of X dollars. So we need to make sure we have that clarity. I'm supportive of growing. I came from a for-profit industry in Albertsons, 20 years there, and you have to invest in capital to grow things. You absolutely have to, but it should be done on like we're doing here in determining how much investment is needed, what the return on the dollar is, and what schedule do we invest in, and where do we invest? Does the horse park get all of it, or do we take that and look at other venues? We have a fixed amount of money we could invest, but what does that look like in the broad scope? So I think this is a good step forward, because I support investing in the overall Fort Idaho Athletic Center, Fort Idaho Center, not the Athletic Center. But I think it needs to be, in my mind, part of a kind of a slightly bigger project where we look at the total capital needs. I think in the history, we've looked at the capital needs as one-offs. What do you need this year just to keep things operating? But we've never looked at it from perspective of what do you need to develop that profitability so we can take the the impact that the city currently uses to fund the Fort Idaho Center and reduce that or put it somewhere else.
Thank you for that comment. And Andrew, I believe you do have a more comprehensive plan for the entire facility. Is that correct for what the capital needs are?
Yes, I did have a call with Doug yesterday, and we're going to work on continuing to develop that even further. So,
okay. I think that's important. And then, and actually, one of the reasons that we have the Venue Management Commission is for them to have the ability. Mark, can you turn my mic down? I'm trying to keep it away. Thank you. I think it's important that we look at the full comprehensive plan and then also the recommendation from the Venue Management Group, because I know several here sit on that, but it needs to be a comprehensive recommendation for the entire property for the limited dollars we have. What do we do? So, and I think the need is great for the RV spots. There's no question about that, but it definitely is something that we need to consider in a very broad perspective. So I think Councilman Haverfield, and then we should totally wrap up within 5 minutes because we actually are running almost 30 minutes behind, and I have a Planning and Zoning Commission that are waiting to go to their jobs, and they are next on the agenda. So, but Councilman Haverfield.
Just a couple of quick questions for clarity. As I'm more of the detail guy, so looking at the book and trying to justify the values that are associated there, how many acres are we looking at developing for RV?
I believe it's about seven.
And how many? I counted 82 RV spots. Is there more than that anticipated?
Depending on the final configuration, you could go between 80 and 100.
Okay. So the 82 count was accurate as I saw it. And so the cost per RV spot is just a generic number that was thrown at it. But so I'm trying to justify the 1.5 to 2 million as far as in total cost. So is there more money being put towards the development of the horse park itself? Is that where the extra dollars will be?
Well, it really depends on what the final picture of the RV facility looks like. We worked with a city architect to develop a plan, and that was their kind of high-level estimation of like $10,000 to $15,000 per RV spot. And depending on, you know, beautification or added amenities to these spots, it could be higher, it could be lower. You know, that's certainly, I think there's ways to do it cheaper and maybe in a phased approach, but for today's purposes, we included the one.
So is that paved surfaces for the, as far as the general circulation patterns, and then paved surfaces for the vehicles to park on as well?
Yeah, gravel pads.
So would that include water, full service hookups, like a typical RV park then?
Yes.
So you'd have underground costs associated with it?
Yes. Okay. That's captured within the fee, yeah.
Thanks.
Are there any other questions?
Mayor, no question. Just this statement. And I mean, they want to keep it real simple. And if we brought in taxpayers in the future, and just know how it's going to affect them and, as far as the whole comprehensive plan. So from a taxpayer's perspective, where they can have a total understanding of the of how it would affect them in positive ways and how it can affect their pocketbook. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you. Do you guys have any closing comments?
You know me, I always have a comment, but, you know, we just appreciate the time that you've given us here today, and I think it's important that you as the leaders, and I sat in those chairs, I sat where Natalie is sitting now, and understand that you have so much money that you can spend. Also know that we have to present a real need for that. And we, as partners, we're asking you on your side of the partner fence to help us with this project. And, you know, in the past, I could go on and on about what we spend, what we continue to spend. Right now, we're in the process of putting in redoing the rodeo club, if any of you have been up there. So we're putting in new tile and painting. We're trying our capital projects every year include the Idaho Center. If the Idaho Center doesn't work, we don't work. So that's why we have to cooperate with each other, with Andrew and his crew. They have a little bit of hesitation every year when they see all the red shirts come out. Their crew does, because we put them to work, and you know. And but it's a worthwhile project. It's something that we can't keep putting off. There's no way we can put it off and say we'll pay $50,000 a year. That would never get it. And if the people years ago hadn't have went forward with some of the things that they did, it wouldn't. That's why we're proud to wear Napa on our collars. Because when we go places now, it's Napa's a place to be. And whether you look at economic impact or not, it's still, if we're a growing community, you're third in the state right now. It brings its issues, but it brings a lot of good community vibes that we all enjoy. So we appreciate everything, every one of you, and I know the job you're doing is hard. I'll leave these with you. There's two more letters here for each one of you. That's from Peterson Dodge and from the Equine Hospital, and I'll give them to you if you can get them out. Thank you very much.
Mayor Kling, if I could just ask one more question. Okay, Andrew, this is for you. So of the RV, park now, what is the annual amount that's paid and given to the Fort Idaho Center?
Just for RVs alone, we're probably looking at a couple hundred thousand, but the more important part is the ancillary benefits, the stall rentals, the food and beverage sales, and getting exhibitors to these horse shows. That's really what's going to drive it.
Oh, I see. Sorry, thank you. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
Can I make just one more? I just clarify so that you understand where the National Rain Association, they has eight regional, throughout the whole North America, actually, so it includes Mexico and Canada, they have eight regional championships. And we host the one in the Northwest. We're actually the largest out of all those eight. We've been fortunate to have the contract for the last 8 years. It expires this year. So come September, I've got to put in a bid for 2023 and beyond. And I can just tell you that the competition that I'm going to have in Oregon and California have more RVs, and that's one of the ideas. So when Andrew and I present to Oklahoma City and this board of national directors, I just need something on September 1 when I make that. I've got to have a plan. So
September 1 is your...
That's when I have to put in the submittal for war. I'm going to lose that contract.
Thank you for sharing that.
All right, thank
you. I just want to say, George, thank you. You've been a wonderful partner. It's been exciting to see the growth and what you've accomplished, but it's because you put a lot of work into it. So thank you so much. We value it.
I did say partnership. We, you know what, I don't put on a big horse show. I mean, we put on a big horse show.
That's everything.
People come to Napa because they enjoy coming to Napa. They're spending recreational dollars to be here.
Thank
and,
you.
And we appreciate that partnership.
Thank you. And I'd like to say thank you to the Stampede Board, to all you red shirts. Thank you for what you do for our community, recognizing it is a tremendous amount of work. The only reason we have an amazing rodeo is because of the effort that you guys put into it as volunteers. And I know it's kind of a full-time job as you get closer to the actual date, but your work is really appreciated, and we're so proud of our rodeo. And then to the Horse Park Foundation, thank you for your work. Thank you for your fundraising. Thank you for your dedication, because it's your work and commitment that has made the Horse Park what it is. And so we don't take that lightly. And I'm sure I'm missing someone, but I will say, and we've said this at our recent council meeting, Andrew is doing an absolutely stellar job. Extremely thankful. Thank you, and to Spectra and the company for their support to you. And you're doing an amazing job. So we have a great facility. But Curtis, thank you for your comments, because you recognize we have limited dollars, and trying to figure out how to do it is not easy sometimes. If you want to do one thing, advocate with our legislature, because they, even the new bill that landed out yesterday with no public hearing, what they're doing is they're cutting the revenue that is available to the city. Last year it was $1 million. That $1 million adds up year after year when we're not allowed to put it in our budget. Right now what they're suggesting is that one of the blessings of the strong budget surplus of the state is that we get state shared revenue. And the bill that just landed yesterday, would 50% of our state shared revenue increase would not be able to be utilized in our city budget if that bill goes through the way it is. And so, and I haven't fully read it, and I need to make sure I'm misstating that, but that's kind of the direction that they're going. I'm hoping that bill doesn't go forward. But each year we're in a battle for budget, and it makes it really hard to figure out what to do because our revenues are being limited by decisions our legislature's making. So feel free to advocate to the legislature to be careful what they're doing that impacts city budgets, because those are those dollars that then we don't have to make these investments. So anyway, thank you so much. Appreciate you being here. We'll let you go. And then for planning and zoning, thank you for your patience. We are going to step right now into the next item on our agenda, which are planning and zoning items. Have a great day, guys. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Mary, would you like me to come forward?
Yeah, if you would. So we're going to begin in the order that you see on our agenda, industrial design review, zoning code for multifamily parking, and conclusions of law. To our Planning and Zoning Commission members, thank you for taking time to be here today. We really appreciate it. I'm sorry it's an early morning and you're waiting. It's the reason we have these workshops is to have a discussion. And I think it's important that we have a discussion. The next time we get together, we're going to get to be seated, I think, in a square. Because the city council chambers is going to be remodeled. That project begins the end of this month, and there will no longer be chairs here, which will be a change, and some people won't like it. But it's going to give us the opportunity to better utilize this space so that when we get together, we can be here, but we can be at a square facing each other. So that's going to be great, and I'm excited for it. So, Rodney, thank you.
You bet, Mayor. Mayor and Council, this can be more of a discussion than a presentation. You have several things in your packet, and I'm happy to go over some of the details here, but we're primarily, can I get it just be switched to the screen, to my screen here? We're primarily going to talk about three topics on the agenda. The first one is the discussion about industrial design review. We currently have design review. You can see this in 1034-3 that goes to a committee, and those two areas that go to a committee every time are anything commercial that's over 5,000 square feet, and anything that's multifamily, meaning 5 units or more in a building. So anything below that would not go to the design review committee, but would go to staff for a design review by staff. So there are multiple things I could cover today, but I just wanted to get a sense of the council's desire to have industrial development go through design review. And I'll tell you why that's important, a couple of things that go into that. We have a lot of industrial in the works right now, a lot. I've never seen it like this. Our economic development team has never seen it like this. We have a lot of interest right now. And so we're going to be seeing these industrial projects coming forward in the really near future. And right now our code doesn't say that they have to go through design review. There are very limited aspects of an industrial development that are required. Landscaping buffer between residential, that's one of the main ones, and then a buffer out in front. But there's not any criteria to guide the appearance of the building unless we put it on them in like a development agreement or something. And so that's the question. Do we want to see all these? And over time, that's been acceptable because we felt like that's an industrial area. We're not going to see that. However, we're seeing that those industrial areas are developing in key corridors for the community, in key gateways even. And so we could go a couple of different directions here. We could go through a design review committee process just like we do for every other development. I think that's on the next section here. Let's see. basically we would just add the zones that would require design review. We'd add IL and potentially IH and IP. So that's one way we could do it. That has significant impact on staff, though. I can assure you we cannot handle that workload right now if we do this. If we go to committee review and do staff reports, we cannot handle it with our current staff load. So we likely need to look at increasing our staff numbers, probably just by one, we think. But we'd have to watch that carefully. The other alternative is to go to like a staff review. That still takes a lot of time. So and the only concern I have about that approach is that there are some things that are kind of subjective, right? And staff, we often pride ourselves as being objective, right? Like we want to, if the code says this, then you do that. But there's some things in the design review standards that are just subjective. You need to look at it and analyze whether it meets the code. And so there's a little bit of concern there, but we do that for something smaller than 5,000 square feet right now, and we do it for multifamily that are less than 5 units. And we do the best we can, and then they can appeal that decision to the design review committee. So I just wanted to get a sense from the council about your willingness or your desire to have that happen. We would have to come back with a zoning code amendment for this to take place, and I would have to work out the details and present it to you for your consideration. But I just kind of wanted to get a sense first from you and maybe even the commission if you would like them to participate in this.
And Commission, if you guys do want to speak, just come forward to the microphone. I'm sorry that we're set up this way, but the way the workshop is. So if anyone has any comments, you're welcome to. And I'm going to follow with Rodney. I feel strongly about this because, and I will just say, Robin, you had an interview yesterday, didn't you? Was it Idaho Business Review?
Yes.
Talking about Nampa being an industrial hub, right? So would you, I would give you the opportunity to say something, but I feel strongly that we need to have some design standards on industrial, because if you look at even across the street from Amazon, that's an industrial park. We've got a lot coming in, and they are key corridors. So go ahead.
Yeah, so Mayor, City Council, yes, I had an interview yesterday with Idaho Business Review talking about Nampa as an industrial hub. I did say that we've always been an industrial community. That's manufacturing has been an important part, starting way back in the early 1900s, but with amalgamated sugar, it's a critical piece. But now we have 2.5 million square feet of speculative industrial development out here. You know, that's a lot. And so we have a lot of developer needs looking at what we're going to have in these buildings, what they will look like, especially along the 85 corridor by Amazon. We have a lot of industrial going in there and interest in there that's so high visibility. So it's an important part of the process to have that design review.
So do you feel like, and that you're working with so many of these companies that are coming in, because my thought is, rather than going to design review to actually put the design specs in the code, that they have to build 2X. It needs X to the glazing, and we talked about glazing and not putting the standard glazing because it wouldn't be cost effective. But looking at the appropriate percentage of glazing and the elevations on the roofs, that sort of thing. Do you feel that that would be overly burdensome to the developers that are coming in and doing this, or is that something that they really are expecting as they come in?
So Mayor, Queen, Council, it's a mixed bag, and so some are just fine with that. Some of our larger developers, it's not a big deal. Some of our smaller, then, you know, there's a little bit of like, oh wow, that's quite the requirement, but they're able to do it. And so I think for the city's needs and what we desire to have and what our community to look like, it's an important element.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
And Ron, do you mind coming forward? Ron Van Acker. I'm sorry, it's like... yeah, you were looking around, I'm sorry. The reason I'm calling you for it is because you sit on the Planning and Zoning Commission, but you have been in the industrial development space for a career, and so I think it would be nice to hear from you kind of what your thoughts are.
Yeah, thanks, Mayor Clay, members of the council. You know, thinking about it, a lot of other jurisdictions have a design review process for industrial facilities, and I think the only issue you would, feedback you would get is the extra time it takes to go through the process. NAMPAS has a streamlined design review process and get people on the committee, so I think we can get through the process pretty quickly and efficiently, but I'd be careful on what conditions you put on industrial buildings. Like you said, the glazing does not work in industrial. And thinking about it, the quality of industrial buildings has changed quite a bit in the last 10 years. It's not metal wall panels and a roof anymore. These institutional grade, there's some of that being built, but these institutional grade investors that are in the market, developers building this institutional grade product, are using concrete tilt, parapet walls. It's nicer looking stuff that they're building. And, you know, we've always prided ourselves in building that institutional product in a non-institutional market, and it benefited the market and our tenants and the community, I think. So, I don't know if I'm making sense at all, but landscaping, we always put it in before NAMPA had the requirement to put it in, because we like our business parks and industrial parks to be desired by tenants. Tenants like landscaping, but they like efficient landscaping. So when our neighbors to the east required turf landscaping everywhere, we really pushed back and said, look, let's put in drought tolerant stuff that doesn't take a bunch of water, and turf and trucks don't usually mix because it gets run over when big trucks are taking corners too closely. But anyway, I think it's a good idea. I don't think it can be held to the same standard as everything else in that section of the code. So I think there needs to be some thought process as to what to put in there. That's kind of all I got. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Thank you for letting me put you on the spot.
Yeah, no problem.
I appreciate it. Council, what are your thoughts as we move forward?
Mayor, just a quick thought. Individuals like Ron just need to be, which I know will happen, because our folks here are very smart and entertaining those who are in the field day in and day out, but we just need to get their advice. And yeah, I personally think we just put the standards in there where anyone who's coming in can say, hey, yeah, this is what NAMPA is about. Do we want to be there or not be there? And make the decision rather than going through a long process of committees, etc.
I feel the same way. I think it's important. If it's in the code, then they know what we need. And so there's no surprises. It's there. It's ready to go. And we don't. I am concerned about the extra workload. And so as long as we, in the code, identify what it is. So I have a thought. Why don't we put together... Go ahead.
Can I say one more thing?
Yep.
That could work, yeah. One more thing. Maybe we look at the different areas in the city, because North Napa has a very large industrial area now, with all the annexations that have happened from Cherry Lane up to USIC and beyond. So maybe in like a large industrial park area already designated, it's a staff level design review process, and if it's close, you know, an infill piece or something close to commercial and all that, then we go full committee process. I don't know if you can do that, but that would lighten the burden on staff, I think, because Rodney's right, it will take a lot of time, and you start working with developers and architects they want to get through the process as quick as possible, but it's kind of like, not to pick on the attorney, but it's kind of like working with attorneys where you give them your recommendation and then they want to change it and it goes back and forth and it can bog them down. So, is that?
I think it's a great idea. So, you know what I'd like to suggest? That we just go ahead and put together a small committee, and Rodney, I'm sorry, that because it'll get to be you doing it, that consists of a couple of Planning and Zoning Commission members. And Ron, because of your background, I might suggest you be part of that. Only because, I mean, you understand it from your perspective, and then someone else, and I'll let you guys decide who that is, and then two council members, and then whoever else you think should be on that committee. Maybe Economic Development should participate. But and then why don't you guys talk through what that you think that code should be, and then we could come up with a something that we can present. What do you think? Randy, do you have thoughts? You're getting your steps in.
Yeah. Again, on the I have to serve on the committee. I've kind of started in the whole financial underwriting side of the business, so just thinking back there. We want to, every condition you put on could potentially add costs, and I think in this market we're probably the highest construction costs that we've been in for my career, certainly. You know, my dad used to build buildings for $30 a foot, now they're about $100, so if you're lucky. But we don't want to get too high above the market. Every major market I go to and look at industrial stuff, Nampa, Boise, Meridian is, from a rent standpoint, about 15% higher, which is interesting. But if we can do it efficiently and not add too much cost, I think that would be important.
Okay.
Mary Lee?
Yes.
You're okay, Ron. I don't have a question for you. I'm just going to make a statement.
Okay.
Thank you.
I was talking to one of the members of the Interframe. Company on Franklin. They are probably one of the top two in Southwest states that build truss joists. And they told me yesterday that if Napa would hurry up and let the permits go through quicker, that we could sell more wood. And that was coming from the builders, the developers, because they can't make enough quick enough. So I like this idea of streamlining, and Ron, you got a good idea. Streamlining this whole process to make it quicker and better and faster, and not bog down on our planning and zoning people. Good idea. No, I'm going to agree with Dara on this one. Usually I know what I do on this one.
Councilman Haverfield.
Thank you for what you said. I think from a developer's perspective, whenever we add another layer, we're adding another month or two. And that's time, that's money. And then the other side of it, as far as with staff reviews, they're more competent sometimes than some of those that are sitting on design review commissions because they volunteer their time, but not all of them have a background in design, understanding aesthetics and the reality behind things. The only thing that I would caution staff on is we need to make sure that what's put in writing is clear enough so that like the Van Auker product from a few years ago was a composite wall construction, and I remember seeing that. It was a great looking wall panel, but it was composite. It wasn't a tilt up concrete, so it was a. That's where some of the values I think were able to be adjusted downward. So, but they still are there today. I mean, they're good looking buildings. So whether it's masonry or steel or concrete or composite wall construction, there's a lot of different aesthetics that come into play. So it's the articulation of the wall heights and in and out. That's what would be defined. And then from a design standpoint, we would look at that chapter and say, okay, we're meeting the expectations here, and this is how we're doing it. And if it became a question by staff to the design professional, how did you meet this? Then it's all right there and defensible. Sitting or waiting for a commission to meet, again, is you're either going to be asking them to meet more often or, they're taking on a burden that they're not capable of really understanding, whereas our staff has more of an in-tune ability to do that. So I would agree that a staff level review would be more than acceptable in this case.
It sounds like we have a council volunteer for our committee.
I think you're right.
I second that.
Thank you.
As long as Ron's on it.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you.
That's
so
good
I think
direction.
That's the conclusion on that one is that we'll move forward putting a committee together and you guys will come forward with some recommendations on what those standards should be. Mm-hmm. Okay. Zoning code for multifamily parking. Thank you, Ron.
You bet. So, the next section is in your packet. Kind of hard to follow the packet because it doesn't have page numbers on the whole thing. But I just wanted to, I've had some conversation with Councilman Jangula about parking. And I thought I'd give this to everyone, and then we could talk about how we proceed with considering parking. Just the history here, early 2021, City Council and Planning and Zoning Commission, we held workshops together. Council directed staff to propose 3 parking spaces per unit in a future code amendment for multifamily. So we took that out to, we were also given the direction to talk to developers about that and see if that's feasible for them. So we went to the developers and found that they were just really concerned about that number of 3 units. So instead we proposed 2.5, and we took that to the Planning and Zoning Commission. They suggested, well, let's reduce that a little more to 2.2. We brought that, the staff recommendation of 2.5 and the Planning and Zoning Commission's recommendation of 2.2 to the City Council on September 7th of 2021. And you considered it, and City Council found, here's the action letter said this, City Council found that multifamily units being constructed are typically having less drivers than single family homes and believe the city shouldn't require more spaces than a single family home is required to provide. Council discussed the financial strain increasing the required parking spaces may have on the free market. They also felt that 2 is a standard requirement used by most communities and that with ADA spaces, space requirements, they are providing more than 2 spaces per unit. So we continue to see some concerns about multifamily and parking elsewhere. They may not have enough spaces in their multifamily development. And so we're just looking at this again. I talked to Meridian the other day, Caleb Hood, their planning and zoning director, and found that his is based on, their code is based on the number of rooms per unit, and so you total up the number of rooms. Eagle is the same situation. The Meridian code, though, however, is primarily still looking at about 2 parking spaces for like a 3-bedroom home. It would just be 2 parking spaces. So every apartment that has a 3-bedroom in that apartment would only require 2 spaces for that one. But completely willing to look at any changes to parking code you would like to see. And I think this might be just a good discussion for you and the commission to have.
Thank you.
Mayor Klee.
Yes.
Rodney, not so fast yet. One of the things, I agree with Councilwoman Jangula, that our parking issues for apartment complexes and now a joint venture with residential are circling those. So our standards, to me, are antiquated. We need to bring those up again. I don't understand the 2.5, 2.6, like Meridian does. How do you get 0.6? I don't understand that. But we all, yesterday, or last week, went to the wheelchair training that with our advocacy group that says that our parking stalls are not as up to par as we should be. So I'd like to take a good hard look at that. It's a good idea, and I think
Councilwoman Jenkins brought up a very good idea of expanding that, and I'm all favor for that, Mayor. I think that's a great idea, especially these new subdivisions coming in with being encircled by apartment complexes.
Councilwoman?
Yeah. Thanks, Rodney, for letting me put this on here. So for me, I'm just having a really hard time approving these multi-use developments, I guess, just because with the parking situation for high densities already complicated, but then if there's not enough parking and then they're overflowing into the subdivision that's connected to them, it just doesn't create very good synergy. So I reached out to Caldwell, Eagle, Meridian, CUNA, I think that was it, City Council. And the one that I liked the most was Eagle, and they do it like Meridian per room, except for, so they require one parking space per room and then an additional 0.25 for guest parking. I'm not saying that's the golden rule, but I feel like with the housing market the way that it is, and I don't see it changing anytime soon, a lot, like our dynamic for people living in apartments has changed. It's not so much young families or elderly people anymore. It's families with kids in middle school, high school. These are more, they're more drivers, or these are college students that are needing to cram a bunch of roommates into an apartment. I mean, that dynamic's changed, so it's not, I just don't feel like there's enough parking, and we've seen that. Multiple apartment buildings that I've driven by in Nampa, the one across from Still Falls especially, right, there's not enough parking, and you'll see just cars lined up down the road, and they're getting ticketed because that's a city street. So I just feel like that as we grow, we need to be smart with what that looks like, and I'm having a hard time approving those.
So. Mayor, if I may, we just need to be careful that we don't require things of specific projects that we wouldn't require of other projects. And so if we want to make an effort to increase the parking, we need to make a code change so that it's consistent for all people.
So one thing, yes, go ahead.
Sorry. Just so that everybody's aware of what current standards are for a fourplex, it's two parking spaces per unit, plus ADA, depending on how many units you have in your development, one additional space per every 25 spaces provided, plus an 8-foot wide loading, unloading zone that's provided, which is almost like another parking space. For that fourplex, it's 5 plus spaces that are either on surface or in garages. So that's the current requirement. So when you try to start from a design standpoint, figuring out how you're going to provide this additional parking that you're talking about, it's going to be on the perimeter, it's going to be exposed, it's not going to be protected parking, which is subject to vandalism and then becomes unsightly. A great example of parking that concerned about the amount of parking that is being provided, like for shopping centers, was Karcher Mall. You look at what's happening behind it now, all of that asphalt was additional parking being provided because of the requirements that were established to meet the requirements of the council, the ordinance. That is now becoming housing. So it was never used. It never had a use. So be careful when you start walking down this path, because what you end up creating is something that long-term is more of a detriment than it is an asset. I don't care. From a design standpoint, if it says 3 per unit, I'll make it work. But that's, there's not a need for it right now, the way that I see it from a design standpoint, with the ADA requirement and then the aisles that are required for handicap accessibility as well.
One of the things that I noticed was that we did have some public hearings that, and this has been a while ago, and the citizens brought forward some pictures, and it was duplexes or townhomes, and they showed all the street parking and what a mess it was. And it was a really unsightly picture that appeared to really devalue the area because there wasn't sufficient parking. And so when we say that a unit has two parking spaces, well, those are on their driveway pad. And if they have a vehicle there, then people are parking if they have extra vehicles on the streets. One thing that I have to say, I like where I live, and it is townhomes, they have additional parking, three different sections, and it's a small area with like three and four parking spaces for guests, and there's no on-street parking allowed. And it makes for a very safe environment because you don't have, you know, people walking between vehicles, and it's a much more enjoyable environment because you don't have street parking. And I think that's one of the challenges that we face is that how many cars are on the streets and then wherever, like you had mentioned, over by Still Falls. So I don't know what the answer is and how to do it, and I hate to say this, but my thought is we need to have a discussion around it. I think that we would owe it to possibly do what we're doing on the other industrial side, but this one would maybe have some citizens join a think tank. And then would you be interested in being part of that?
Sure. Yeah.
It's yours to where we pull, again, a couple Planning and Zoning Commission members, a couple City Council members, and then City Council. I mean, Sandy, you may want to be on one of those or another council member on one of these two committees. And I know it's more work, but maybe come back and revisit. And you guys are going to be the experts on what our code is and what our citizens and developers are needing. And what that right decision is for our community if we need to change our code, and then come back with a recommendation. Rodney, I know, and Cliff, maybe we can figure out how to get these done, because I know, Rodney, you're really, really busy to pull these extra committees together, but I do think that we need to have a discussion, and it's important that planning and zoning is a part of this discussion, so you guys can help guide us. And then if someone has an idea of someone that needs to be on that committee, would you let us know? Who you think needs to be on the committee, besides the two people from the commission and two people from council. I'd like to have some citizens on that committee, and I don't know who that is right now, but you guys may have some good ideas. Are we? Yes.
Mayor, I'm going to be a little obstinate. On the first committee I'm totally in favor of. I'm not. Committee, I think, can just get overburdened with staff, and also I don't know what if the result is really excellent. To me, we have cities around us. We have a council person that's also an attorney, but in Meridian, Eagle, you mentioned. So what's working in these areas? You mentioned your townhomes. What's working? Mm-hmm. I don't think we need a committee. I think that can be researched. I think recommendation can be made. There's always positives and negatives to whatever recommendation, but I don't think we need spend a lot of time with a committee on this. I think that...
Well, let's put it this way. Maybe committee is the wrong word. There needs to be a meeting. Because I feel that it's important that we have a meeting and have representation from planning and zoning at that meeting.
I know, I agree with
that. And so that's really what I'm saying. Maybe not a committee, because it may be done in one meeting.
And I love citizens' participation, but you're going to have citizens all over the board on this right. type of thing. Just like Randy mentioned. It sounds like both sides of it, we're having street parking, whether we have more spaces or less spaces, it's still going to happen. But just be as efficient, I guess, is what I'm...
And well, I think agree
as
that.
A city mayor, you're very efficient. I'm just saying, let's not get out of that mode.
Okay. Well, I agree with that, and it does when you say committee forming, because it's really not, in this case, quote, committee, but we need to have a meeting, right? And I want to have my... What's important to me is that there's representation, that we have planning and zoning representation, city council representation, when we're talking about code and we're all dealing with it. And then if there's somebody else that needs to be in that meeting, you guys decide what staff needs to be in the meeting and then come forward with a recommendation to the change. Are we good with that? Okay. Okay. Reverend Bill, thank you for being here. We still have one more item on the agenda. Are you okay? Okay. And this will take a little bit. So thank you. We're going to start conclusions of law. Rodney, we're going to start with legal.
Yeah, I was just going to kind of outline that. That our attorney... Joe Borton is going to speak about conclusions of law, what they are. I'd like to follow up just at the end there. I've got some handouts. So the Planning and Zoning Commission, we did a little bit of a training on conclusions of law when we got new commissioners in. And we give them a handout that every single time they meet, we put it on their desk in front of them. It's just kind of a guide to help them make the decision and make the motion that's before them. So I've got some of those that you can look at, and then we can talk about how we might move forward with that approach too if we want to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cliff? Thank you, Rodney. I appreciate that. Joe Morton, good morning. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, good morning. So, who's on planning and zoning? Okay, good. I'm kind of, I don't know which way, I'll face this way, but comments going to everybody. You might know my partner, Tom Lake, you see more of him, but some brief discussion and direction, maybe stuff you already know and apply, but on conclusions of law, I wanted to touch on a couple of quick comments on process and a couple of on substance. So the big picture point of these comments is to make sure that the meeting, whether planning and zoning or council, is effective. And whatever it is that you decide, that it's effective and it's lawful. And there's a couple of things that are just reminders and requirements to do. From a process perspective, whether it's chair of planning and zoning or the mayor, having this discussion and deliberation of your decision run through the chair, through the mayor, is critical. Every now and then, a zoning commission or a council can get unintentionally kind of off the rails. If the conversation isn't run and routed through the leader of that particular meeting. So that's very important. Another important part is for the land use types decisions, there's always the prohibition on ex parte communication. It came up at City Council a couple weeks ago. If there ever is, for a land use application, if you ever get contacted, email at the grocery store, don't wait for the public hearing. The second it happens, the day it happens, let the city clerk know. Best practices, let the clerk know, Jane Doe contacted me, wanted to talk about X. I told them, thanks, no thanks. Don't wait for the hearing. If it happens like the day of the hearing, at the start of the hearing, say it. It's really important. That's a procedural requirement. It's not optional. Just to make sure the public knows that it's proper and fair and that the applicant does as well. So that's a mandatory. Just a couple of refreshers on the process. Those steps matter because the conclusions of law that are required for, we're talking just land use applications. It depends on what the application is, but planning staff does an excellent job in providing a cheat sheet, for lack of a better term, that outlines what the conclusions of law have to be based on. And these are basically the reasons for your decision, the justification that why a particular application is approved or not. We're going to talk more about highlighting the type of application and some of the existing entitlements that a project might already have or what it might not have. So an example would be just highlighting the difference between an annexation application and what entitlement is. There's no rights there to the property yet. It's an annexation that comes with perhaps a zone request, perhaps a conditional use application as well, development agreement, as opposed to different types of applications, such as just a conditional use permit. The conclusions of law and the required findings that the Planning and Zoning Commission or the City Council has to put on the record. First, best practice is to start with a discussion. So the process of the meeting, everyone already knows. But you get to the end of it, and the applicant makes their final last word to help make you effective and make the decision, whatever you decide, lawful, to avoid any request for reconsideration, is best practices to have some deliberation. So for an example, a zoning commission member or a council member may say, at the end of all of that, here's my initial comments and thoughts. Wait until you've heard everything, heard from the public, heard from the applicant, before you provide any initial thoughts and comments or perspective. Because that shows everybody that you're truly listening and compiling all the information before making decisions. But it's really important because skipping this step is going to create, whether it's requests for reconsiderations or legal challenges, it creates the perception that you've predetermined your decision or you haven't received everything. So really is the best practice for whether it's zoning commission or city council to properly get to conclusions of law is to have discussion. even if the meeting's not closed yet. But to have discussion of, you know, my initial reaction is, you know, I have problems with this application, and here's why. Here's the specific factors on this application. And I'm concerned about its time of use or the noise or dust abatement or you know, some of the design criteria or transportation, whatever it is, you got to say it. And you need to say it on the record. It's critical for planning staff to make findings, whatever the decision is. And then have other zoning commission members or council members provide comment. And Councilmember Rex says, why? That's interesting. Here's my perspective, having heard that. That deliberation is just required to be part of the discussion. It also then avoids any challenges down the road. That allows you to create conclusions of law. Now, you may, whether you approve or deny something, that's not the point of, I guess, this kind of refresher course. It's how you get there and making sure that you engage in that discussion on the record and with detail, especially if there's concerns. And one of the, I'll stop with that.
A quick question, just to clarify, you're suggesting that that discussion takes place before the motion. Is that what I'm hearing? Yes, okay.
Thank you, Mayor. Absolutely. Making the motion first and then discussing, one, it's not required, and two, it invites that perception that you decided it already before you even talked about it, which is not what's happening at all. But then if you get requests for reconsideration, you're just doubling your work for staff, doubling your agendas and planning and zoning. You're just creating more work. So it's best to just share your thoughts. You know, I'm inclined to favor this, or I'm inclined to oppose it, and here's why. It's not a formal motion. But after that discussion back and forth, that planning and zoning chair leads, pulls out of the commission members, or Madam Mayor, you pull out of council members, you know, additional thoughts and comments, then invite a motion. Based upon all that discussion, now planning staff has some meat in the record as to what and why the ultimate motion is to approve or to reject something. The applicant and the public know. They might disagree, but at least they know what it's based on. You've got specific criteria that can create the findings of fact. So the cheat sheet, I'll finish on this, the cheat sheet that's provided outlines what those conclusions of law are and how zoning commissioner or council tips one way or the other on an application. It's based on those facts that you all share and discuss. That's what allows you to say, and therefore it's not harmonious with the adjacent neighborhood, or et cetera, et cetera. In one last thought, I know P&Z does conditions of, or CUPs primarily, right? Unless it's with another application. One of the challenges with CUPs can be, and a reminder of it is, a conditional use permit is an existing right to do a type of use in a particular zone. They can do it with conditions. Whether there's conditions that might be appropriate to allow that type of use, but it's not like an annexation where it's complete discretion of the decision maker. Conditional use says that A zone allows that type of use if certain conditions are met. And your city code lists a bunch of different types of conditions that you can place. And that's what some of the reconsiderations may be based upon. Wanting to know, the applicant wanting to know, what are the conditions that you would have placed on me that would get me to yes? Is there anything within this list that would allow my project to proceed? Again, that's some of the dialogue that we want to pull out at the meeting, in the deliberation, or that type of application. It's just going to allow the end result, whether any project gets thumbs up, thumbs down, there's not any legal challenges to the ultimate decision they make. That's kind of a fast snapshot reminder of what you know, but these are steps that just can't be skipped.
And it's difficult right now because we have a couple of requests for reconsideration, so we can't talk about specifics. At some point when we get beyond these, I would like to have some discussions, more specific discussion, because I think it may be needed, but we really can't at this time. But so this is just a broad overview. And planning and zoning, you get to just sit here and listen as we're, but we just needed, I think, the an area for we as council that we're, that's a little bit new, is really confirming the findings as to why, if a denial comes forward, we have to specify that. And we need to make sure it falls within the areas that are designated. Mm-hmm. And so, Rodney, I'll let you come forward and show us the cheat sheet that you have for planning and zoning, and we need it for us. So I'm going to ask that we get it, too. Thank you. I think you mentioned you're going to maybe update it.
I am, yeah.
Madam Mayor?
Yes.
Sorry, there was a handout.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I'll remember it, but it's okay. I have a question about at the meeting, when the applicant comes up and speaks, are you saying it is okay or not okay to ask them questions about their application?
And Joe, would you repeat the question as you answer it?
Yes. So when the applicant speaks, can you ask them questions? And absolutely. That's encouraged, that discussion.
On last Tuesday's meeting, we had a lot of people here in either for or opposition for the project. And I asked the people to identify where they live so I could make a good decision as to whether these people had a vested interest or a non-vested interest in the application. Is that okay?
It's not illegal by any stretch. Yeah.
Well, to me it made it important because there's a lot of people who are opposed to it and they're 10 miles away. I don't have as much empathy for them as I would somebody who lives next door.
And could you repeat what, because you're on a microphone,
okay.
So could you repeat that comment?
Yeah, so determining whether or not people who want to testify where they reside, if they've got a vested interest or not, one of the criteria or factors to weigh into the, I guess, the weight you give the testimony of the citizen.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, that's totally permissible.
We had some public hearings where we realized partway through the public hearing, even though they had an address, none of them lived in city limits. They were Caldwell city limits, but they were the majority of the complaint against the decision we were making within the city of Nampa. And so that is where it definitely can weigh into our decision. So just to clarify, though, the question I believe that you asked was asking the applicant questions.
Well, it was two questions.
Correct. And then the other one was the second about where they live. But we typically don't ask, but we do, and I just want to clarify, asking someone in a public hearing that is testifying, not the applicant, but just a citizen testifying, the practice of asking them questions. Can you speak to that?
Certainly. Asking a member of the public questions, it's not prohibited. Really, it's just the practice of the entity if they choose to do so. Some do, some don't. You know, depending on how many people are testifying, is it speeded up or slowed down? But it's definitely permitted to ask questions of anybody who provides testimony.
Thank you.
You bet.
Are there any other comments or questions? Do you guys have any comments? Nope? Okay.
So, Mayor and Council, the handout I gave you was primarily designed for the Planning and Zoning Commission. We can certainly revise this and update it and make sure that it's consistent with our recently adopted code. I don't think there's very many changes at all, but we can also make it more consistent with, for your consideration if you need. But I just wanted to emphasize one of the things that we heard from the attorney is that conclusions of law are the legal requirements that you must find that those are happening, or if they aren't happening, then that's why you deny a project. And the difference between a conclusion of law and a finding of fact, we hear those two phrases. Conclusions of law are in the code. Here's what you have to find. The findings of fact are the basis for how you come to that conclusion. What were the facts associated with the project that you're making a conclusion? Yes, this applies here because X, Y, Z, the findings of fact. So again, we just have this little handout that has been really, I think, really good because the commission can just turn to these any time in the process of the meeting and look and see, okay, what are the criteria? What's the conclusions of law we have to base our decision on? The other thing that I think we're going to start doing, you'll see very soon, actually on Monday, is that staff is going to try to hit the conclusions of law first thing in our staff reports. So we will go over what we find for the conclusions of law. That's a little bit dangerous because we are not the decision-making body. You are. And we only have the facts that have been presented to us at that time. So it kind of gets back to what we were talking about before, where you listen to all the testimony. Well, I might not have had all that testimony when I look at the conclusions of law and I find that, hey, this conclusion of law is not applicable. Well, maybe the testimony brings out, actually, it really is. And that's okay. If you find that you disagree with what we put in our staff report for conclusions of law, no offense taken. It's just this is what we have found up to this point from a staff perspective. You are the decision-making body. But we're going to try to do that first thing in our staff reports and in our presentations to City Council. Those are the basis for why or why not, or why you should or shouldn't approve a project. So is that helpful? Would this be helpful to have? And we'll continue to put it in the staff report and on the screen as well, but this will be maybe good for consideration.
Thank you. And Rodney, if you don't mind me mentioning, Rodney and I did have a discussion about the sometimes in a public hearing or with the applicant, they say, well, the staff told us.
Yeah.
And we had a discussion around that, and Rodney, I'll let you answer that question rather than me.
People always say things like that. So first of all, in that specific case, I was there in the meeting. I give options. I don't direct someone to take a certain course. I say the code says this, and here are your options. You could do this, go this direction or this direction. So I only provide options. I don't give them, you must do this. There's lots of ways you can get to a project being approved. And maybe that's a comp plan amendment and zoning map amendment. You know, that can change things dramatically, but we just give them options. And then second of all, I think we talked in that same meeting, a lot of times applicants will say, oh, we've been working with your staff. It's been so great. You know, they're so great to help us. And I always cringe a little on that because it's not that we are helping them. We're not advocating for a project. We are advocating for the code and the plans that you have adopted. So we give them options. And yes, we work with them, but we also work with the public who have concerns about a project. So I just wanted to emphasize that. That's our approach in the planning zone.
Thank you, Rodney. So I know we're really late on time, and I want to get to Reverend Bill Roscoe. Council, do you have any questions?
Mayor, I want to thank Joe for the reminder that it's always best to have deliberation before we launch a motion. I think what we've done in the past, at least in the recent years, is we've gotten into a pattern of, well, let's just launch a motion, get a second, and then talk. And I like the idea of not doing that. It sets us up for failure sometimes, where we have to rescind a motion or, you know, so let's have the deliberation first.
Thank you for that comment, because it does get confusing even to the audience. And one thing I'd like to say real quickly, we have our new city clerk sitting here, Char, and so she decided to watch today rather than preside, but I think you're up here on Monday night. And in case planning and zoning has not had the opportunity, so Char is our new city clerk, and we're excited to have her on board. And one thing that she did say that she's going to do a little differently is that at the end for city council, when we do roll call, at that time she's going to say what the actual final vote was, so that there were four in favor and two against, or whatever it was. She's going to restate that. That way it's clear in the audience there. And I know you guys, planning and zoning doesn't have anyone there, and you don't have legal there. I mean, you don't have a clerk's group, right? So I think, who is sitting at your meetings? And I'm sorry, I can't come to them. I should.
Karen.
Karen always is, okay. So if you guys have any suggested changes or anything as we move forward, please let me know, right, whatever your needs are. Because I thank you so much for the work that you do. It is so important, and it is greatly valued and appreciated.
So, I have one question.
Yep.
Has there recently been I know we're a lot busier, we're growing a lot in the community, but is there an overabundance of requests for reconsiderations out there right now?
So the question, and I'm doing this because of online reporting purposes, Ron Van Opper was asking if there had been an overabundance or request for reconsideration. And we've had about three, I think, in the last couple of months. Would that be correct? I know we have two pending right now. We have...
Yeah, the quick answer is, I mean, one is a lot, just because the idea is, whether it's the public or the applicant, they didn't get or appreciate how the decision was made. So they want the process to be done again. So...
Okay. So, Council, I know Cindy may need to go. We're going to be about 10 minutes over, but I'd like Reverend Bill to come forward. As Council may be aware, the Boise Rescue Mission Men's Shelter is currently closed, and I would like for Reverend Bill to share the why, and then that way you are aware of it. And then I will say that there was a meeting, due to time, I'll do it while Reverend Bill's passing this out. We had a meeting this week over at the Civic Center with Canyon County, and there were some amazing ideas that came forward for use of the shelter. So I think I'll be sending you an email from Brian Taylor that of some ideas that they have for the shelter, and then we'll also share it with Reverend Bill.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Thank you for the invitation to come this morning and chat with you. I just handed you a statement that we created after our board met on Tuesday to talk about the situation at the Lighthouse Rescue Mission and to give you the history here that led to this statement by the board. Over the last several months, the numbers of homeless men coming to the Lighthouse Rescue Mission has been small and continuing to dwindle. Over the last weeks of January and February, the numbers were as small as two men per night. And as that situation progressed, I was talking with my board and thinking about the cost that it takes to run the mission, whether there's one person or 65 people in there. And when it got down to two or three men per night, hardly any meals, even food box requests, which used to be fairly regularly about three or four a day at least, those were dwindling down to maybe two or three a week. So as we considered our staffing situation and as we considered the cost of maintaining the facility open for homeless shelter, it didn't make any sense to us at the end of February to continue to have the rescue mission open for the numbers of people that were using it. It seems to us that there wasn't a great need for men's shelter in Nampa. And I understand that statement conflicts with some of the news that you get, some of the word on the street out there about the numbers of homeless people in the county generally and men in particular. But I can just tell you that from what we experienced at the Lighthouse Rescue Mission, there really wasn't a need to maintain that facility, staff that facility, and pay the expense of all of that for the numbers of people served. And as we announced the closure at the end of February, there were three men, one of whom checked out immediately at that news, and then there were two other men who had already advised staff that they were going to be leaving March 1st or soon thereafter. One of them was waiting on an income tax refund. And so we facilitated the move of those men into the places that they had predetermined to go to by funding some of that and helping them along the way. So no one went out onto the street out of the rescue mission on March 1st, but on March 1st we closed the building. This statement then tells you our conclusion at the moment of what to do there. We will, as I say in the opening of the statement, we will continue to look at the situation for homeless men in Nampa and the West Valley. And if we see a change there, if you see a change there, if we suddenly have dozens of men on the street here who might be interested in shelter, then we'll reconsider opening the shelter again for men. But meanwhile, we're going to use the facility, as I've indicated in the note or in the statement to you. We have offices there. I have an office. My assistant has an office. We have probation and parole in the building. They've been there for a long time. Our chief of security has an office there. Our event staff has two staff members in the building and offices. And the University of Idaho will manage our garden again this year, the Veterans Garden. And they'll have access to the building as well. And we may add to that as time goes by. We'll just have to watch and see. But the bottom line is the board concluded they do not want to they do not want to sell the property at the moment. They don't want to lease the property on a long-term basis at the moment. We want to keep all of the options open to provide homeless services to men should that need arise in the city again. And I'll take any questions that you have.
Well, I really appreciate that update, and thank you for this from the board, right, what you guys have decided, so thank you for that.
Certainly.
I know there has been discussion and ideas that have come forth even this week, so this is this update's really helpful, to know that you're not interested at this time in selling the property, long-term leasing the property, you're going to wait and see and continue the activities listed. That's good. Thank you. So, Council, do you have any questions? Yes.
Riverville, I know there's about 2,500 to 3,000 high school students that are homeless. Have you looked into that aspect to see maybe you can house them, or is that an alternative for you?
Mayor, Councilman, we have looked at that, and to house minors, anyone under the age of 18, is a special situation, as you know. And we aren't qualified at the moment to handle those residents in our shelters. And I think another thing that's important to note is that the count that is done by the school districts and others sometimes include those students who are sheltered, but they're not sheltered in their own home permanently, so to speak. They might be at Uncle Joe's for a week in Grammys and so on. Because I have communicated with Nampa Police over the years about that issue to see are there homeless camps of children and minors, and the answer has always been no, or very few kids living on the street. So with that in mind, we haven't felt like it was necessary for us to step into that gap, and it's a tough gap to fill.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, sir.
Certainly.
Bill, over many years, you have done an excellent job. And we so appreciate the service in our community. And I know that it's been an interesting season watching what you've watched and seeing especially the men's, but even today, the women's isn't full,
right,
is my understanding. And that's such a unique thing. And I think one of the things that could be because of some hotel vouchers or whatever, mm-hmm. but I just want to say thank you because you have been a wonderful steward and have worked really hard to ensure that we've met the needs and supported the homeless in our community. I appreciate that, and I think our responsibility is to pray that that Bill and the team, the board, has wisdom in how you move forward, the direction you move forward, and I really appreciate the fact that you're willing to collaborate with community members in the discussion about how you move forward because of the impact to our local community. So.
Well, thank you, Mayor. I appreciate that very much. And you did hit one of the notes that I've been made aware of over the last week, and that is that there are a lot of people, homeless people, who are now in motels with vouchers that have been funded by the state, I suppose, or the Fed. A lot of people, and I was surprised by that. And that will go on until the end of September, according to the person I spoke to who knows these things. And they are, that same group of people is endeavoring to make that a permanent grant for those motel vouchers. Whether that will happen or not, I don't know. But at the moment, there's a lot of people who would ordinarily be homeless who are staying in motel rooms paid for by the state or other resources. So I'm sure that's where some of the people that we used to serve are staying now.
Mayor, I do have just a comment, and thank you, Reverend Beale, for all that you do. And I just thank you for keeping your standards. And I guess my question on, I know a good friend with the Phil Altmaier who runs Spokane facilities. And he, like you, I think you have stated, communicated, you have beds open.
Oh, yes.
People want to, just certain drug and alcohol and whatever standards. So I guess my question is, on these vouchers for motels and so on. I know I've talked to Phil somewhat extensively about what's happening in Spokane. Of course, he's very, very concerned. How are they controlling the drugs and so on in these motels with those who are staying? Do you have any idea what their plan is?
No, I don't, sir, Mayor and Council. I have no idea what the plan is, and I don't have any idea about what's going on in terms of the people using the vouchers and any conditions for use that are implied.
I know he states that there's two or three city blocks in Spokane where you can't even walk because of needles and other things, and the police are just kind of overwhelmed. So anyway, I'm concerned about that, but thank you for holding to God and to what you believe. So
certainly. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you for waiting, and thank you for the opportunity for us to get to hear from you for the entire council.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity. Anytime you want to chat with me, just let me know, and I'll be here.
Thank you so
much. Have a great day, and God bless you. Thank you for your service to our community.
Thank you. So, Council, just a quickie. These need to stay here because they are left on the bench for P&Z, and then they'll be put on the bench for us at City Council, and then they'll stay. So you can just lay them up there, and Rodney will get them. I thank you. I know we're over time. I just appreciate the Council's willingness to do these workshops because they're important. We need discussion time. And so in a future one, we're going to be talking planning for the city, but we didn't get that done this time. So I would stand for a motion to adjourn the meeting.
So moved. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you all.